Hi, it's Duncan Strauss, not live, but the Memorex version. At the moment, I'm on vacation with my family, but I wanted to mention a few quick things before today's edition of Talking Animals kicks in. First, I want to thank everyone who donated in support of Talking Animals in the WMNF Summer Membership Drive, both those who offered donations and tipped our contributions before our Fun Drive show last Wednesday, and those who pledged during that program. I really appreciate the support. Thank you very, very much. Also, it's a little odd that I'm not here live today in that this show pretty much marks the 12th anniversary of Talking Animals. Not at WMNF, I've been here a little less than a decade, but sometime in 2002, I conceived the unusual format of Talking Animals, worked on developing and honing it for several months. I've been in music radio for decades, but had never presented this type of program. Then, on June 13th, 2003, at KUCI, a little station in Irvine, California, I launched Talking Animals. The show wasn't very good at the beginning, to be perfectly frank, but 12 years in, I'm starting to get the hang of it. Still, this family vacation will involve me missing today's show and next week's program, on which Bev Capshaw will be sitting in. And then I'll return with you live on June 24th right here on WMNF. As for today's Talking Animals, it's in large measure an encore broadcast of the April 8th show, featuring my interview with Helen McDonald, author of H is for Hawk. 6 months ago, I was spurred to speak with McDonald chiefly because her book was extraordinary, having received rapturous acclaim and major literary prizes. As you'll hear in a moment, I was blown away by the book, and the ensuing months since I spoke with Helen, the critical acclaim has clearly translated to commercial success. The book soared to the upper reaches of the New York Times bestseller list, and just now, H is for Hawk made it on the iBooks recommended summer reading list. So I think that's everything. Please tune in for Bev next week, and I'll be back with you 2 weeks from today. Right now, it's Memorex Me with Helen McDonald. Cue the Rebecca Pulley Talking Animals theme.
Walks like an animal, talks like an animal, must be an animal, come hear the animal, talking animal, talking animal. Walks like an animal, talks like an animal, must be an animal.
Good morning. This is Talking Animals. I'm Duncan Strauss, and my guest today is Helen McDonald, author of H is for Hawk, one of the most acclaimed books published within the last year. Plunged into debilitating grief when her father died suddenly, McDonald, an academic historian at Cambridge, decides the thing that will help bring her some relief is to train a goshawk, a large and particularly fierce bird of prey. H is for Hawk is a singular combination of grief memoir, account of McDonald's experiences training her goshawk, and biography of T.H. White, author of The Sword and the Stone and The Once and Future King, who decades earlier had written a book recounting his experiences as a falconry neophyte. May sound like an unlikely blend, maybe even an uninteresting one, but H is for Hawk is a mesmerizing book that has received some of the UK's top literary awards, including the Samuel Johnson Prize, the most prestigious nonfiction award, and a long string of rave reviews. The New Yorker critic called it, quote, perhaps the finest nonfiction I read in the past year, end quote. We hear all about the book, the goshawk, and more when we listen to my wide-ranging conversation with Helen McDonald in a few moments here on Talking Animals. Let's move into my conversation with Helen McDonald, author of H is for Hawk. Recorded Monday, this is Helen McDonald on Talking Animals. So let's welcome to Talking Animals Helen McDonald. Thanks so much for joining us today on Talking Animals, Helen.
It's great to be here. It's such a pleasure.
Thanks. Well, congratulations on all the awards and acclaim. H is for Hawk is a veritable juggernaut that keeps rolling along, and it must be thrilling, especially given that the kudos span nearly a year now since the book was first published in the UK last summer.
It's just been astonishing. You know, when I was writing this book, you know, writing a book is a very lonely thing. You sit at your desk and you kind of weep and eat pizza and you think you're terrible. And, you know, when I gave it to my publishers, I was convinced it was going to sort of fall, you know, sort of dead from the presses.
Wow.
A book about a miserable woman and a bird. But it's been astonishing. I've been absolutely bewildered and delighted by what's happened. It's been amazing.
Yeah, well, I'm hardly the voice of dissent because I was mesmerized by the book, and I'm keenly interested in animals, as suggested by the show title. But I also have kind of an interest in grief and how people learn how to cope with it. And I'm also enormously interested in great writing. So reading H for Hawk was a pretty powerful experience for me. And you know, one of those books, I'm sure you've had many of these, where you feel like any interruption is a complete intrusion on your time. And it's like, hey, my kid, yes, he's 11, but would it be that unsafe if I didn't pick him up at school and he just hitchhiked home because I'm in a section where I really don't want to stop reading? But
oh, no, I feel terrible now. I'm so sorry.
Well, luckily, better parenting prevailed, and I did pick the kid up. And I'm just saying that, you know, it was that, like, sort of gripping where you just feel like, hey, I just don't want to stop. And anyway, so what had been your experience with loss before your father died?
I would have been a very lucky person, I think, and until my dad's sudden death. I hadn't really any sort of real knowledge of loss. I mean, I lost a grandparent, and that was very sad. But I think you know, there was a kind of unspoken loss. You know, I had a twin brother who died just after he was born, and I didn't know about this until I was about 18. It was such a horrible event for my parents. They just couldn't really talk about it. So I think that sort of deep down, you know, that sort of early loss, I think it maybe encouraged my interest in birds of prey. You know, it's very weird. There's a very long sort of tradition in sort of myth and legend of birds of prey standing for the souls of people who've died early, particularly children. And I kind of, it's weird. These old stories kind of, you know, they stick in your mind. They come from sort of deep places. And I guess there was that early loss which kind of made a big difference to me in my life.
You know, I was going to even ask about that. Sort of borders on, maybe even goes past the line of armchair psychology. But I couldn't help wondering in reading the book if the loss of the twin, which you didn't really know about, I think, till you were, I guess, in your teens or something.
Yeah.
But still, we all have things that are sort of bubbling under the surface that we don't necessarily know about or can't articulate. Mm-hmm. And I just wondered if that, in retrospect, had given your dad's loss just an added oomph, because it obviously was devastating for you.
Yeah. Yeah, and not just that sort of sense that you go back to a time when you know, learning how to handle grief. You know, I think I talk a little bit in the book about how my obsession with falconry might have been connected with this early loss, and how, you know, falconry is all about things, taking things and kind of getting them to sort of like you and fly to you. But of course, with a hawk, you know, they can always fly away. You know, falconry is basically a way of sort of keeping an animal as a kind of companion, but it's completely loose when it flies, and it could disappear at any moment. And I think, you know, that my obsession was about that when I was small. It was about things that I'd lost and things that I wanted to come back. And then when my father died, that all kind of flourished again. I hadn't been flying hawks. I hadn't been a falconer for some time. And this sense that I needed to be with an animal, with a bird of prey, a sort of ferocious bird of prey, and somehow kind of live with it and let it fly was tied up with this very early loss, I think, yeah. But my dad, you know, he was a really, really good friend of mine. You know, people have sort of said to me, but you were 37 when he died, you know, why were you so upset? And I'm like, you know, it doesn't really matter how old you are. If you're lucky enough to have a really, really great parent and be very close to them, you know, the shock is horrible whenever they go.
And like you say, too, I think also if you're, on the one hand, lucky enough to lead a sort of a charmed life where you get into your 30s and beyond maybe, and don't experience that kind of loss, all the more you're sort of ill-prepared.
Yeah, absolutely, yes. I have friends who've had lots of early losses, and they, you know, you learn how to kind of armor yourself against them, and I just didn't know what to do when he died. You know, it was a very sudden death. He had a huge heart attack and was just suddenly gone. And I think the suddenness was it kind of just tore the world in half for me, really. I didn't really know what to do with myself. I was pretty broken.
Well, this is Talking Animals. My guest is Helen McDonald, whose acclaimed new book is H is for Hawk. This conversation was recorded Monday. Maybe, yeah, describe your struggle with that loss in sort of the initial period after your dad passed, and how you arrived at the conclusion that one way to ease your grief would be by training a goshawk.
Yeah, I don't recommend it, by the way.
Oh, yes.
You know,
it's not universal.
Yeah. You know, if you've suffered a big loss, I don't recommend going out and getting yourself a goshawk. It's a bit strange, isn't it? But, well, I guess, I was a historian. I was an academic historian, and I went out and bought loads of books on mourning and bereavement and grief, and I thought all the answers were in those. And I read all these books, and I didn't kind of understand what they were trying to say to me, you know, and I just sort of thought, this is all. And I thought I was doing pretty well, but I went back to my job, and I kind of, you know, was marking essays and kind of, you know, tutoring kind of students. And then I started dreaming of goshawks. You know, I dreamt of them every single night. This one particular goshawk that I'd known years back when I worked in a bird of prey or a raptor center. And it was one that had knocked itself out while it was hunting. And we sort of checked it over and then let it go. It was fine. And we watched it just disappear over a hedge into nothing. It was an extraordinary moment. This bird that was suddenly, you know, it was in front of us, it was bright and terrifying and almost like a dinosaur, was suddenly gone. And that sudden absence of the bird, that sense that it disappeared into another world, I think was working within me. And I just dreamt of them all the time. And then suddenly you know, knew that that was what I wanted to do. I wanted to train a goshawk. So I ordered one on the internet, which sounds worse than it is. I did know the man. I bred it. And I found myself, going up to Scotland to pick up this 10-week-old baby goshawk.
I'd love to have you read that passage where you first encountered that guy. But, I mean, given that falconry is so rich with long history and tradition, I did find it a bit disorienting that you got your goshawk through the internet. It just felt like, hey, what's wrong with this picture? This just seems like, among the least likely ways that you would meet up with your goshawk.
Yeah, but it does sound a bit weird, isn't it? Yeah. In America, in falconry in America, it's possible to trap wild young birds and fly them for a year before you release them. It's a kind of way of borrowing them from the wild, and I really like that. It seems a very sensible way of doing things. In England, all the birds of prey we use in falconry are bred in captivity. There are no wild birds taken. And I guess, you just sort of use the grapevine to find the right person. And breeding goshawks is pretty hard. They're not easy birds in any sense. They're very highly strung, very predatory, very ferocious. And if you're not careful, they'll sort of kill each other in their aviaries. So, I had to find someone who I knew could do a good job. And this chap in Northern Ireland, Andy, bred the most beautiful goshawk, so I was very happy to find him.
So let's have you, if you don't mind, read that passage where you first meet your goshawk. But you said something a moment ago that just reminded me, was it, although you were having these dreams about goshawks, was it because, again, you were so deep in the throes of grief and just didn't know what to do with yourself, was it in a way kind of precisely because goshawks are so complicated and high-strung that in a way almost any less challenging of a bird would have maybe failed to provide the kind of sweeping diversion that you saw?
Absolutely. Yeah. I trained many, many birds of prey before, from owls to eagles and falcons, but goshawks had this reputation as being, the most difficult bird of prey. With most birds of prey, once you've got them tame and used to people, they just stay that way. But goshawks is a constant battle to keep them sort of friendly and used to the world you're in. So it was an enormous diversion. It was kind of, I have a friend who, he says when he has a fever, he'll press his hand to his forehead very, very hard. And then suddenly all the kind of, fever disappears and all you can feel is that hand on your forehead. And I think the hawk was kind of like that. The hawk is such an extraordinary thing, so full of life and it's just amazing creatures. And, once you've got one of those on your gloved fist, the rest of the world just falls away. There's no time or space to think of anything else.
All right, if you don't mind, let's have you read where you first meet your internet-purchased goshawk.
Yeah, so I went to a Scottish quayside. I mean, it was an extraordinary moment. I was sort of wandering around. It was a bit like a drugs deal. I had £800 in my back pocket. I felt it was all very dubious. And this lovely man turned up with a box, and we had to check the hawk's ring number. It has a kind of band on its leg with a government number on. And this was my first sighting of my goshawk. Another hinge untied. Concentration, infinite caution, daylight irrigating the box. Scratching talons, another thump, and another thump. The air turned syrupy, slow, flecked with dust, the last few seconds before a battle. And with the last bow pulled free, he reached inside, and amidst a whirring, chaotic clatter of wings and feet and talons and a high-pitched twittering, and it's all happening at once, the man pulled an enormous, enormous hawk out of the box. And in a strange coincidence of world and deed, a great flood of sunlight drenches us, and everything is brilliance and fury. The hawk's wings barred and beating, the sharp fingers of her dark-tipped primaries cutting the air, her feathers raised like the scattered quills of a fretful porpentine. Two enormous eyes. My heart jumps sideways. She's a conjuring trick. A reptile, fallen angel. A griffin from the pages of an illuminated bestiary, something bright and distant like gold falling through water. A broken marionette of wings, legs, and light-splashed feathers. She's wearing jesses, and the man holds them. And for one awful long moment, she's hanging head downward, wings open like a turkey in a butcher's shop. Only her head is turned right way up. And she is seeing more than she has ever seen before in her whole short life. Her world was an aviary no larger than a living room, and then it was a box. But now it's this, and she can see everything. The point source glitter on the waves, a diving cormorant 100 yards out, pigment flakes under wax on the lines of parked cars, far hills and the heather on them, and miles of sky where the sun spreads on dust and water, and illegible things moving in it that are white scraps of gulls. Everything is startling and new stamped on her entirely astonished brain.
Wow. Well, that's an that's an example of why I was so engaged at times where I felt like I wouldn't necessarily want to pick up my kid at school, even though again I did decide to. But
yeah, that's a kind of a really sort of full on part of the book. You know, I wanted to try and get across how the bird was so astonishing and so amazing to me that I was going through all these ways of trying to understand what I was seeing. You know, and it was difficult to understand because it was such a phenomenal moment. You know, it was all these different things at once.
And also, I mean, just that incredibly sort of poetic passage that you just read, and then we've got this very sort of fierce bird of prey, and then while we're on the topic of unlikely aspects like getting your bird on the internet, you named your goshawk Mabel.
I did name my goshawk Mabel. It was kind of funny. You know, there's this kind of tradition in falconry that if you name your hawk something like Slayer, you know, or Beelzebub or something like that, it will just sit on a fence post and squeak at you. So people tend to give goshawks really silly names. You know, I called my hawk Mabel. I have a friend who has a goshawk called Bunty. I have another one who has a goshawk called Baby Doll, you know. and they tend to be really amazing falconry birds if you give them silly names. It's an old tradition. But also, yeah, you know, Mabel is an interesting word. It comes from the Latin amabilis, meaning lovable. And I think that even though I was trying to cast myself off from the world and cut loose from people, I think I really was looking for some love somewhere, and I think that's maybe why I called her Mabel too.
Sure. This is Talking Animals. I'm Duncan Strauss. I'm speaking with Helen McDonald, author of H is for Hawk, recipient of the Samuel Johnson Prize, the Costa Book Award, and rave reviews in the New York Times, the New Yorker, and just about everywhere else. This conversation was recorded Monday. So recount something of the early days then. You've met Mabel, you've named Mabel. Count the training, the good, the bad, the ugly of those initial days.
Yeah, so the first thing one does with a bird of prey, I mean, these birds are captive bred, but they're completely wild. They're not domesticated. So the first thing to do is to try and persuade them you're not a monster, you know. So I just withdrew into my house. I drew the curtains closed. I unplugged the phone, and I became a kind of a monkish figure, really. I just withdrew totally from life, and I sat there for hours and days on end with this bird on my gloved fist, with delicious bits of steak under her feet. And falconry is, you know, interesting because, you know, it's very, very ancient. It's about, you know, I guess 4,000 BC was when it first started. So it's been kind of perfected over millennia, really. And you can't train a hawk by being cruel to it. You just can't. You know, they're not, you can't even frown at them. They don't understand punishment or you know, appropriation. You can only really get them to do what you want through persuading them that you're a good thing. So it was all about food to start with. So there were sort of long hours of me sitting there with this hawk, and eventually she decided that I was a good thing, not a monster, and started to eat and become much more relaxed with me. And eventually she would jump to my fist for food and then fly to me. And then came this strange time when I had to actually take her out of the house and get her used to people. And of course I found this really rather strange because I didn't really want to see people, and I found the people outside pretty much as frightening as my hawk did. It was a very weird experience.
A shared anxiety.
Yeah. And my hometown is Cambridge in England, and it's a pretty eccentric place. You know, you can wander around wearing, you know, academic gowns and talk Latin. I mean, that's fine. But walking around with this huge great bird on your fist, you do get some pretty weird looks. But something had happened again. I'd spent so much time with this bird, and all I was thinking about was this bird, and I started to kind of see the world through her eyes. And I'm sure that many people listening to this have trained animals or have lived with animals, and you know that, you know, to understand them, you just have to read their body language very carefully. But when you're on your own completely, and all you're thinking about is what the hawk is thinking, you start to kind of really see through the hawk's eyes. And I went outside, and I'd see things like, you know, there was a woman throwing a ball for her dog, and I just thought, oh, you know, what's she doing, you know? The whole city was a very strange place. I'd already started to do this thing that was part of the big, I guess the big escape, really, was to kind of not just escape from the world by locking oneself away with a hawk, but basically trying to escape who I was. I was trying to become that hawk in my imagination.
Yeah, I mean, reading H is for Hawk, it's clear that you were trying to lose yourself by way of losing your grief. And in training and flying Mabel, that's what happened. And then there was a certain point where, you, as you say, you sort of really started maybe looking all the way through her eyes and becoming a goshawk, and sort of said, hey, I may have gone just slightly overshot what I was going for here.
Yeah, absolutely. And I mean, it sounds so overblown and strange just talking about it, and, you know, now. But I was watching her fly and hunt like a wild hawk across the landscapes near my home, and I just, you know, saw the world very differently. It was a very addictive thing to be with the hawk. And I was a mess, you know. I'd managed to sort of push my grief away, but I'd wake up in the morning and my face would be wet, where I'd just been crying, you know, in my sleep. And I realized at my father's memorial service, this very moving moment, that I realized that, you know, I'd bought into all those, what those nature books say, that, you know, when you're broken, you should run to the wild and it will heal you. But I'd just taken it way too far. You know, I was a mess. I was covered in mud and thorn scratches, you know, and I hadn't brushed my hair for 3 weeks, you know. So I ended up realizing that, you know, that you can go too far into the wild. And I ended up going to a doctor's and having a long talk with him. And, you know, I ended up going on antidepressants and slowly managed to crawl my way back into the human world. And I kept flying the hawk, and that was great. But it was a real lesson in it was a kind of a trip to the underworld and back, really, with a hawk by my side. It was a way out of myself, and I had to find myself back in the world again.
Yeah. So as you kind of noted along the way there, it really did, your work with Mabel really did begin to resemble or even become an addiction.
Yeah.
And we did need to kind of swing back from that. And talk of the addiction element may provide the right moment to discuss an important presence in your book, T.H. White. Maybe you talk a bit about him and why he and his work is so meaningful to you, and that was sort of a powerful pull and element, obviously, ultimately, of the book.
Yes, T.H. White, and I think your listeners might know him from as the author of The Sword in the Stone and The Once and Future King, those great retellings of the Arthurian legend. You know, he was very famous in the 1960s, but he's kind of not so well known now. So in the 1930s, he tried to train a goshawk too, and his reasons were different from mine, but he was kind of doing the same thing. He was trying to run away from who he was through training a goshawk, you know, and his demons were that he was... he had a really horrendous childhood. He was, you know, a really broken man. He had a very abusive time with his parents and at school, and he was gay, and that was obviously a massive problem back in the 1930s for him. So he wrote this book about trying to train this hawk, and he made a terrible job of it. And I read this book when I was small, and I was so angry with him. I hated him. You know, he was so ignorant, not only about how to train hawks, but how to show love really to anything, that this hawk suffered greatly. So I guess part of my reason to train a goshawk was not just that hawk I saw early on that we let go at the falconry center that disappeared into another world. It was partly that I sort of realized as a child that maybe when things are really bad, what you should do is train a goshawk. So I tell his story in the book. It's kind of tangled up with mine. It's a kind of conversation with him, obviously quite one-sided. And I try and understand why he did what he did and why he saw the goshawk as a mirror of his own kind of needs and brokenness. Because I was doing that too, you know. I saw the goshawk as everything I wanted to be, this solitary, ferocious thing without a present or without a past or future, you know, living in the present, and that was what I wanted to be. So yeah, the big theme of the book is this lure of using nature as a mirror of yourself and how that can be very dangerous.
And it seems like the running element of T.H. White in some ways was kind of ultimately a primer on what not to do when training or flying a goshawk.
Yeah, he just didn't get it at all. And, you know, when I wrote the book, I didn't want it to be a kind of massive, crushing critique of this man, because he just was ignorant about what to do. You know, he overfed the hawk. You know, there's an awful bit where he's trying to persuade the hawk to fly to him on a line, a sort of long line attached to its leather straps called jesses on its legs. And rather than try and wait for it to fly to him, he eventually gets so cross with it, he sort of pulls it off the perch with, you know, by sort of tugging on the line. And this poor bird, you know, it's a horrible thing to read. But yeah, he eventually loses the bird. You know, he sort of engineers its loss, really. I think it would have either been him or the bird at the end of the book, because he kind of started to not really understand which was which, I think. You know, was he the hawk or was the hawk him? But it wasn't supposed to be a searing critique of him. It was supposed to be, you know, I felt quite compassionate towards the man. He was a very difficult character, and I don't think he'd have liked me or me him if I'd met him. You know, he didn't think women should vote. But I wanted to just sort of uncover the reasons why someone might get things so terribly, terribly wrong.
And was the T.H. White element always intended to be such a prominent part of the book?
He was always going to be in there, Duncan.
Yeah.
But it wasn't until I went to Texas and spent a long time in the Harry Ransom Center there. They've got all his unpublished, his unpublished papers and manuscripts and journals. And I looked through all these things, and it was a very strange experience. He started to kind of haunt me. You know, these books are full of photographs and bits of feathers and things stuck in with sort of tape. And you can see bits where he's very drunk and his writing goes all over the place, and there are bits where he's been crying, and you can actually see his tear spots still staining the paper. And the more I read, the more I felt that he was standing behind me, you know, and I just sort of thought, he has to be more... There has to be more of him in the book. He has to have a voice in the book as well.
Yeah, I wasn't sure which came first because I thought, again, obviously it is a prominent element of the book. And then when I learned that you had kind of decided to go all in, really, traveling to Austin to read his papers, I thought, well, either you had decided at that point this is going to be a key element of the book, or by taking that trip and finding what you did and going through those papers, you thought, okay, well, this I'm just going to keep going with this.
And the kind of reason for that, too, is another reason, and that's that, you know, when you read nature books, they're so often, well, they seem to me so often to be books that explain in this kind of single voice, you know, this is how nature is, you know, aren't you lucky to have me to explain this to you? So I wanted the book has got more than one voice in it. It's got my voice in it, it's got T.H. White's voice in it, it's got a kind of imagined voice of my Hawk as well.
Yeah.
And I wanted all those things to kind of get tangled up and talk to one another. Because I think when you've had a big loss, the idea is that life is just one straight single story kind of crumbles.
Yeah.
You know, it's a complicated, messy thing after you've had a big loss. And all those different voices sort of are trying to say that.
Right. And sort of on a parallel level, a measure of the richness of the book is that there are all kinds of tiny things that I found just really meaningful or fascinating. Like, for example, you just mentioned the nature books. And there's an observation part of one of the White sections where you say something about how many of our classic books on animals were by gay writers who wrote of their relationships with animals in lieu of human loves, which they could not speak.
Yeah.
Can you kind of expand on that? I just thought that was really kind of a fascinating thing, almost as an aside, but to me it was really significant.
Yeah, I just thought that was it both incredibly poignant and also fascinating. You know, for people from Gavin Maxwell, who became very famous for writing books about otters, there's a whole bunch of people, Ackley, the chap Ackley wrote about dogs. These were people who just couldn't talk about close personal relationships, or couldn't write about them, couldn't speak about them, because they were, you know, unacceptable in the climate of the time. But of course, you know, they wanted to write about love, they wanted to write about closeness, they wanted to write about who they were, you know, through their relationships with other things, and these things became animals. I just think it's part of that theme about using animals as mirrors, is the way we use animals to say things that we can't otherwise say out loud for us.
Yeah.
And I think it's a very moving and very sad reflection on society back then.
Absolutely. Yeah, and I just had not had occasion to think of it in quite those terms till I read your observation that way. Again, this is Talking Animals. I'm Duncan Strauss. I'm speaking with Helen McDonald, author of H is for Hawk, one of the year's most acclaimed books. This conversation was recorded Monday. So another thing about H is for Hawk, at least parts of it, is it is not a book for sissies. I do confess to a few sissy moments myself. For example, Mabel, the relentless aggressiveness of her attacking her prey, and then moments where you describe having to kill rabbits or pheasants, you know, with your hands, chiefly designed to put a seriously injured dying animal out of its mercy. But your actions and your descriptions of those actions, well, again, not for sissies.
No, and it's the great irony of what I was doing, of course, and that is I was trying to run away from death, and yet, by training a hawk, I was seeing death on a daily basis. And I feel very strongly, if you keep animals, it's very important to let them fulfill all their normal behaviors. And of course, goshawks are about death. You know, that's what they do. And I think I say in the book that keeping a goshawk and not letting it hunt is a bit like having kids and saying you're not allowed to play. It's kind of what they're made of.
Yeah.
So I watched her, you know, I watched her fly, and she was hunting rabbits and pheasants and stuff. And in the wild, as you say, you know, goshawks just start eating when they catch something. You know, there's no reason for them to try and kill things cleanly. So I had to rush up and put these things out of their misery. And that was the most deeply, I don't know, it was a very strong and educational experience. And I don't want to make light of it at all. You know, I'm quite a sentimental person. I even hate to kill flies if I see them in my room, you know.
Yeah.
But I realized that we just don't see death anymore, you know. Billions of animals are killed every year and eaten, but it all happens behind walls. And when I had to go in and do this thing to stop these animals suffering, it made me feel very responsible for who I was and my place in the world. And it was educational in a very, very, very deep sense. And, you know, it was never done lightly. It was never a bloodthirsty thing. I wasn't out there to kill stuff. But it was a great and curious and very serious puzzle.
Yeah. Well, again, it was part of the richness and sophistication of the book because, yeah, you're clearly an animal lover and sensitive in that way. And yet, once you stepped into the world of goshawk training and flying, as you say, goshawks are goshawks and you got to let them be goshawks. So you sort of have to roll with some things that are pretty tough at times.
Yeah, it was pretty intense. Yeah, absolutely. Yeah.
And as someone largely ignorant of the ways of goshawk, you'd mentioned earlier that I guess they're only sort of bred in captivity. So, because I was wondering otherwise what Mabel or another goshawk would have done in nature versus the life she had led with you. But it's from what you said earlier, it sounds like that's not really, there's not really a scenario for that at this point.
Well, I mean, I think one of the reasons I like falconry done properly is that it does pretty perfectly mimic the everyday life of a wild hawk. So in the wild, a goshawk would sit around and preen its feathers and loaf and maybe have a bath, and then it would, when it gets hungry, it'll go out and kill something and stuff its face, you know. Like a bit like, you know, the famous sort of notion of lions, you know, they just lie around then, and then it would just sort of, you know, eat and snooze again, and, you know, whatever. So basically this is what I did with Mabel. You know, she went out and she flew for a, you know, good few hours every day, and when she caught something, she ate. And then we'd go back, and, you know, the only difference was that rather than sitting up a pine tree to digest her meal, she used to watch television with me on the sofa, you know. And, you know, my goshawk has watched more bad house-moving programs and antiques buying programs than any goshawk in the history of the world, I think.
Yeah.
But, so, I mean, it's not like, I think it's pretty much the same.
Okay.
Much the same for the hawk. And you know, as far as breeding goes, you know, eventually I did put Mabel into a program, into a breeding program, but alas, she did pass away a couple of years ago, quite unexpectedly, of a horrible airborne disease called aspergillosis. It was a complete fluke. I think this just sort of hit her very hard, and she died overnight, and I was in pieces, Duncan. You know.
I was going to ask what your feelings of loss and grief were when Mabel died.
Oh, I was in pieces, and it wasn't just me. You know, the lovely man who was looking after at that point, because my circumstances had changed, and I couldn't fly her every single day. So I thought, let's put her in an aviary with another bird, and you know, she can have a sort of relaxing time with this sexy male goshawk. But he wrote me a message, and he just said, you know, I was, you know, incredibly upset. She was the softest goshawk I'd ever known, he said. And then he said, unless you were a rabbit. But yeah, she was a much loved hawk, and I've still got her little government band that was around her leg, and I keep it in my jewelry box, and when I'm feeling a bit sentimental, I'll get it out and just hold it for a bit. You know, I do miss her an awful lot.
Yeah. I'm speaking with Helen MacDonald, author of H is for Hawk, winner of the Samuel Johnson Prize, the UK's most prestigious nonfiction award. This conversation was recorded Monday. Before moving to a couple other things, Helen, just to get back to a side of Mabel that now folks who haven't had a chance to read the book but have heard our conversation might find particularly surprising, is that Mabel ended up being quite playful. And you described the scene or scenes where you guys would sort of toss paper balls back and forth, and at that point it almost might have been a kitten.
Yeah, this was very, very funny, and also very illuminating about people, actually. You know, I discovered quite early on that despite goshawks' reputation for being remorseless killers, you know, with these starry orange eyes and huge great talons, Mabel was really playful. I used to do this thing where I'd scrunch up paper into balls and chuck them to her, and then she'd catch them in her beak and she kind of half close her eyes in bird laughter and throw them back to me, and we'd spend ages just playing like this. And I spoke to a whole group of, you know, of goshawk flying men that I knew, and they were all absolutely horrified by this. They said, you know, you don't play with goshawks. You know, they're sort of, you know, the bird world equivalent of a shotgun. You know, they're just all about death. But I found out quite recently that actually they all do play with their goshawks. They just don't like to talk about it.
Oh, wow. The secret shame. Yeah.
Exactly.
That's
exactly.
Funny. Well, was there a concern, even though it turned out to be a little bit on the phony side, that would sort of blunt the goshawk's sort of instinct and by being playful and having that kind of other element to their life? Or
No. I think that that's... that sense that goshawks aren't supposed to play was much more to do with a long history of how you know, falconry has for quite a while been quite a masculine sport, although it wasn't back in the 12th and 13th century. But in the 19th century, 20th century, it's been very much a boys' game. And boys like to, you know, these particular sort of goshawks, they seem to be seen as these remorseless killers, and that's why people love them. So anything that doesn't fit in with that notion of what a goshawk is tends to be kind of kept quiet.
Sure.
But they're just as complicated and bewitching and strange as any other animal, really. It's surprising. And it was kind of marvelous to see that in operation, that Mabel was, you know, she was partly a remorseless murderer, but partly she was a fluffy kitten.
So this experience, you know, losing your dad and then the time with Mabel goes back a few years now. So looking back, what do you now know about loss and how to deal with it that you didn't know in those earlier years?
That's a really good question. I know that there's no one way to deal with loss. You have to deal with it one day at a time, and you deal with it in the ways that you deal with it, not in the ways other people tell you.
Yeah.
You know, I do feel very guilty and sad that I didn't spend more time supporting my mum and my brother. You know, of course they were just as broken as I was, you know, and I really wish I hadn't run away quite so far from them. They say it's fine, you know, don't worry, Helen, it's just you, that's what you like. We knew you'd get a hawk. What have I learned? I've learned that you just have to wait. You just have to wait, and then eventually the grief you're feeling will just turn into love, but it takes a very long time. And when I think of Dad now, I just think of him with enormous love and gratitude. And it changes who you are. It changes, you know, grief changes who you are. You become a different kind of person afterwards. And the hawk, you know, the hawk taught me a lot. The hawk taught me in particular that the world is full of things that are not like you, and that one of the reasons that you should love animals and love nature and love the landscapes around you is because they're entirely non-human, and that's why they're such joyous places and things.
And how much did the experience with Mabel figure into sorting that out, and how much did writing H's for Hawk and sort of sorting out all those feelings and recounting all those experiences further help you heal or at least arrive at those kinds of insights?
Yeah, I didn't think the book was therapeutic when I was writing it. I thought it was a story that was bigger than just a person and a bird. I mean, I tried to make it about the big, you know, big things about death and life. You know, it sounds very pompous, but I knew there was more in it than just the story of me and the bird. I didn't think, until I wrote the last sentence, I thought it was just a book. And then I finished the book and I felt actually dizzy. I felt tears in my eyes. I had to sit down, you know. And I realized that by finishing the book, I'd said goodbye, not just to my dad, but also to the person I was then. You know, it was a real settling and a proper farewell.
And for the sake of serious aspiring writers who may be listening, please tell me the book I'm holding in my hand here represents a number of drafts and various kinds of rewriting to get to what I am holding in my hand.
Well, I'm kind of rewrote it as I went along.
Mm-hmm.
So I didn't do one big long draft and then go back and rewrite. I just spent a long time on each chapter.
Yeah.
And when I send it to my publisher, I expected rewrites, but I think he changed about three sentences. So.
Wow.
Yeah, but it did take a long time to write and a lot of, you know, sort of scrabbling and at the time. So yeah, it was amazing. I was delighted that it went out kind of as I'd sort of given it in, really.
And so at that point, well, like when you did say, okay, here's the final draft, because I have reworked it along the way, to what extent did you realize, yeah, it's not only having a profound emotional effect now that I've written the last sentence, but I might actually have something special here?
There were bits in the book that I was very pleased with, and these are often the bits that I didn't really feel I had any control over writing. They were the bits that just wrote themselves, and it's an old hackneyed thing for writers to say. You know, some of the book was really hard to write, some of it wrote itself, and those are the bits I was proud of. It seemed like something was sort of writing through me.
Yeah.
But I had no idea. I had no idea that it would be so successful.
Wow.
I'm still pinching myself. I still think there's this other person called Helen McDonald that's got this book in the New York Times bestseller list. I don't know who she is.
Yeah. Well, I'm pretty sure it's you. And speaking of that, we're just sort of in our last moment or two here, Helen, but it would appear that by your nature and temperament, again, reading the book, that you're a watcher, you're an observer.
Yeah.
And yet the success and the claim, and it's been considerable, as we've noted here, has thrust you in a pretty broad spotlight. Mm. So how does that feel to now become more of the observed?
I think this has changed me. You know, doing the publicity and talking and interviewing and doing, you know, events is extrovert work. But I've met so many people over the last few months and talked to them about their own experiences of loss and grief and the natural world that it's changed to how I think about everything, actually. I mean, I just think we're all out there. We're all lonely creatures at heart. And humans are really great, you know?
Yeah.
So thank you, everyone who's bought the book and who's talked to me. It's been astonishingly life-changing.
And I think that they probably would thank you in return, because, again, I think as we all get older, you know, whenever you first kind of have that earth-shaking loss experience, obviously when you lost your dad, and people have them at different times in different ways, but then as you get older and older, you just have to, you know, figure there's going to be more and more loss,
yeah.
And you have to kind of figure out, even if each relationship that you're maybe losing is different, how you can cope and not be paralyzed by it. So
yes, I say in the book that there's this very strange moment when you're young, you think that the world is always going to be full of new things, and as you get older, you realize that life becomes a thing full of holes and absences, and you have to learn how to grow around and between those things,
yeah.
and remember the things that you've lost.
Yeah. Well, Helen, I obviously was affected greatly by the book and really enjoyed reading it and really enjoyed talking to you. We've been speaking with Helen McDonald. Again, the book is H is for Hawk, available wherever you get your books. However you get your books, you can get H is for Hawk there. So, Helen, thank you so much for joining us today on Talking Animals.
Thank you. It's been an absolute joy. Thank you.
Thanks. My thanks again to Helen McDonald. Just now, let's step into the Talking Animals Comedy Corner. An old buddy of mine, Rocky Laporte, is rolling into Tampa to perform at Side Splitters starting tomorrow. This is Rocky Laporte with part of a piece called The Zoo on today's Comedy Corner on Talking Animals.
So I live out here now, so that's good. You know, I went to CLA and all that stuff. So, you know, my buddy, you know where he takes me? I go, hey, show me around Los Angeles. See, he takes me to Los Angeles Zoo. You ever been there? What a piece of that place is. Been in it, think of like four birds and a squirrel. You've been in it, they don't even have good animals. It was like a lizard or something ran by. I'm like, what the hell's that? The guy goes, it's not ours. They didn't even have a monkey, they had like a little hairy Italian guy. You gotta go in there, you'll laugh your ass off. Guy goes, did you see the bird exhibit? I'm like, yeah, that's a nice duck. Zoo. It was like two guys got together. Like, hey, I got a dog and you got a bird. Let's have a zoo. Call up Jimmy. Tell him to bring his cat. Then they charge you to get in there. Do you believe that? It's like $8. It comes out to like a buck an animal. I'm not even making this up. Folks, they had a sign in the bathroom that said, no smoking or eating. What the hell's gonna eat in the bathroom at a zoo? You're like, hey, the zoo don't smell bad enough. Let's go have a snack in the John. And whose job is it to go in there and check on that, you know? You're like, hey, Jimmy, when you're done washing a duck, go to the bathroom, make sure nobody's eating in there, okay?
That's Rocky Laporte with part of a piece called The Zoo, taken from his album Welcome to My World. Coming up at 11 on WNF, it's Rob Loria and Radioactivity. Now rolling into the noon hour, constitutes a full 2 hours of interviews, phone calls, news, and more. Meanwhile, as the prize for Name That Animal Tune, I'll be offering a copy of the Talking Animals Anniversary Bash CD. We'll get to that in a moment. Let's move now into Name That Animal Tune. This is Talking Animals. I'm Duncan Strauss. The show website is talkinganimals.net. And Name That Animal Tune is a giveaway, but please only participate if you haven't won something from WNF in the last 90 days. There'll be a prize, a copy The Talking Animals Anniversary Bash CD to the first person who calls 813-239-9663 and correctly identifies this animal song. It's named an animal tune on Talking Animals.
See you later, alligator.
We may have a giveaway right off the bat. Right? I don't know how much easier we could have made that one. We'll carry on. Now, we have just about reached the end of today's edition of Talking Animals on WMNF Tampa. Rob Laura is up next with what amounts to 2 hours of radioactivity. We visit our website, talkinganimals.net, where we make available all sorts of information, as well as archives and podcasts with past Talking Animals programs. We also have a link to the Talking Animals Facebook page, our Twitter feed, and more. Please like us on Facebook, the show, and or me personally, and follow us on Twitter. You can also subscribe to our newsletter to find out about our guests and a couple of days beforehand and other news from the Talking Animals world. That's all found at talkinganimals.net. I'm Duncan Strauss. Thanks very much for listening. Have a good week. Be kind, animals. Be kind, others. Be kind, yourself. We're closing out today's show, as usual, with an animal song, but I thought as a salute to Helen MacDonald, and, of course, our dear departed Mabel, we do a hawk song, this one by the late, great Sons of Hippies. Most members continue in a new band called Pleasures, by the way. So this is Sons of Hippies with Lady Hawk on WMNF, Tampa, Brandon, Clearwater, Largo, Weekiwatchee, and beyond, Community Conscious Radio. Thanks for listening. Speakers with you again next Wednesday at 10 a.m. on Talking Animals. Thanks.
This time of game is in the circus in a cage. He's trying to break out of the frame, the lion this time. He hears that same old sad refrain, but they can't hold him with no chain, and they just can't denounce his claim, the lion again. And he's trying to get free. He knows that something's bothering me, that I'm not too blind to see. The lion again. Whoa. the line again this time. They couldn't take away his throne. He knows that he must stand alone. He'll need be of a heart of stone, the line again. The line this time again. He's in the circus and a cage. No wonder that he's in a rage, the line again.
Time.